is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The Venezuelan National Constituent Assembly is scheduled to meet for the first time today on Friday in Caracas. This is the group engineered by President Nicolas Maduro to cement his power in a vote last weekend.
This vote today is a sham, it's a fraud, and it should not be recognized by any responsible nation.
That's Florida Republican Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton speaking with CBS Miami earlier this week. The vote was manipulated, according to the voting software company running the technology at the polls in Venezuela. The country's attorney general says he will investigate. But beyond allegations of manipulation or claims by President Maduro that he has a clear mandate to rule, this is an end-around around the Venezuelan Constitution, a naked power grab. Maduro is a dictator, said a White House statement released on Monday. Opposition leaders have been detained in Venezuela. Venezuelans are leaving their country, and the United States is tightening sanctions against the ruling class there. That effort has been led by South Florida politicians. Senator Marco Rubio delivered a televised address Monday night on an independent Venezuelan television news channel, saying he has seen the results of the government corruption there, here in South Florida.
En el estado de la Florida, donde yo vivo, ahí tienen haciendas en Wellington, mansiones en Gables Estates.
The vast horse ranches in Wellington, Florida, and the mansions in Gables Estates, the private jets at our airports, and $10,000 shopping sprees at the mall at Merrick Place, Senator Rubio told Venezuelans. Vast amounts of wealth stolen from you by the families of those in power and those who support them. While the people of Venezuela struggle each day to feed their families, the senator asked, have you noticed how many of your leaders have gained weight? And Florida Governor Rick Scott wants to block the state of Florida from investing pension money that could benefit the Venezuelan government. So here's where we begin this week in Florida and on the roundup. How could Venezuelan politics influence Florida politics? Do you support the sanctions that the United States has leveled against Venezuela? And what about the efforts by the state of Florida to ban business with Venezuela? How is the crisis there affecting you, your family, your community? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to get in on the conversation. You can also look for us on social media, Facebook and on Twitter. Patty Mazzei with our partner, the Miami Herald, is with us from our studios in Doral. Tim Padgett covering Latin America and the Caribbean for us here at WLRN. To both of you, welcome back to the roundup. Tim, what's the latest about this new National Assembly that's supposed to meet for the first time today?
Right. We thought that it would have convened by now, but everything we're hearing out of Caracas indicates that it has not been seated yet. What we're hearing is that a lot of, what remains of supporters of the government have all gathered in downtown Caracas to make sure that no opposition forces prevent the seating of this assembly. But as of now, really, the big news today is that Pope Francis from Rome is urging Maduro not to convene this assembly. He says it's just going to cause more confrontation, more violence in Venezuela, and he's probably right.
Patty, the Pope inserting himself in global politics here in the Caribbean and Latin America, he's done it before. Will he gain an audience with the ruling class in Venezuela?
It seems like his message might be too little too late. I mean, Maduro had asked the Pope to intervene in helping solve the unrest after months of protest in Venezuela, but the Vatican wasn't interested because an earlier attempt by them to negotiate a peace was dismissed by the government. So even though he is a well-respected figure in Venezuela, that the ship of the Constituent Assembly has sailed.
And waiting for the gavel to fall, for it to be seated. Patty, do you have any latest intel out of Caracas about whether or not this first meeting, this seating of this National Constituent Assembly, essentially a rubber stamp for the Maduro administration, will be put into power today?
Yes, I've been in touch with our freelancer, Cody Weddle, who is actually in the Legislative Palace right now, waiting for the installation to happen. It's been a little bit of a chaotic atmosphere. The security forces set barricades blocks away from the Legislative Palace so that only the supporters and the actual delegates of the new assembly could get in. And we're talking 545 delegates. So it's taken a while for them to make their way into the building, their supporters marching to the palace. And so I think that's why we can see this delay that Tim was talking about.
What is it, Tim, that last week's vote did that led to this National Constituent Assembly?
Well, First of all, as you mentioned before, it was quite fraudulent. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happened, more important, let's go back to mid-July, when you had 7.5 million Venezuelans in Venezuela and around the world voting in a symbolic referendum to reject what Maduro wanted to do, this constituent assembly, which is essentially going to rewrite the Constitution. Maduro desperately wanted a larger number than that to vote for his plans to rewrite the Constitution, so they held this referendum last Sunday in Venezuela, which would essentially elect representatives to sit in this assembly, which would become sort of a super body connected to the president.
It kind of creates a new Congress
exactly,
in Venezuela.
Exactly, but one that's really just an extension of the president, and it would rewrite the Constitution to essentially create a dictatorial regime much like you have in Cuba. It's sort of a one-party rule, a very authoritarian setup. And so Maduro comes out and says 8 million people voted to approve this. Well, we've since learned that that was quite a sham, that most independent estimates show that it was less than half that. And the company that runs the election technology for Venezuela has come out and said that as many as 1 million votes, if not more, were simply fabricated.
And, Patty, this company is a Venezuelan company making these claims about its own process that that was really now under global scrutiny for Venezuela. Why would it make these claims as a Venezuelan company about really a tectonic shift in potentially Venezuelan politics?
It's a really fascinating tale because it is a company formed by Venezuelans specifically to lend services to the Venezuelan voting system, and they have since 2004. But now they're based in London, and they've got business all over the world, including in the U.S. And what the Maduro-backed National Electoral Council of Venezuela argues is they're just distancing themselves from this election because they're scared of losing business in the U.S. now that, you know, the head of the Electoral Council and Maduro himself have been sanctioned by the U.S. For taking part in this election. So they're saying it's opportunistic and that the company, you know, made its name off of Venezuelan elections and now just wants to reject them.
Yeah, and what's also very significant about this is that during the past 18 years of Chavista socialist rule in Venezuela, even though things weren't always so democratic, they at least tried to create the appearance of legitimate elections. And now, with Smartmatic saying, no, that's no longer the case, I think that's where we've really seen the break between any claim to democracy in Venezuela and now just a simple dictatorship.
Patty, Tim, has any national government recognized the results of this election in Venezuela? I'll use air quotes around election, other than Venezuela?
Sure. I mean, I've been watching state-run TV all week, and I'm actually watching it now as we speak, just to make sure that nothing crazy happens. And they have been touting supportive messages from the governments of Cuba, Nicaragua, Russia. So these are the remaining allies of Venezuela, mm-hmm. because the international community has really, surprisingly, just united around this cause. And today, you know, this is another threshold. The first threshold was actually having this election that was met with condemnation from Europe and Latin America and the U.S. Today, actually seating the assembly is going to be another threshold that could result in more sanctions.
Talking about the crisis in Venezuela, political and economic, and how that certainly impacts and influences the community here in South Florida directly, as well as indirectly, politically, economically, and otherwise. What's your story to tell here? 800-743-9576. Have you been experiencing this long distance with family members, neighbors, friends, coworkers? 800-743-WLRN to join the conversation. Patty Mazzei covering politics for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Tim Padgett covering LATAM and the Caribbean for us here at WLRN. Patty, the response by the United States government over the past 7 months of the Trump administration has really been directed by Senator Marco Rubio. What has been his role in shaping U.S. response really in the lead up to this vote over this past weekend and since the voting results on Sunday and early Monday?
Rubio and other Cuban-American lawmakers, not just from Miami, have really taken the Venezuelan cause as their own, especially after the Trump administration took a harder line of Cuba, which kind of freed up all these lawmakers to talk about Venezuela. And what we know is that the senator has had discussions with the president, even more discussions with the vice president, Mike Pence, who has been closely following the Venezuela issue, and now with the new White House chief of staff, John Kelly, mm-hmm. who we should remind listeners used to head U.S. Southern Command right. here in Miami and is intimately familiar with Latin America, and as we reported yesterday, has wanted to shape any future Venezuelan sanctions now that he is in that role. So we expect that any further sanctions package that comes down from the White House will have, you know, Rubio, Kelly, Pence approval behind it.
Considering the Florida influence and the South Florida influence, Tim, is this role that Senator Rubio is playing in regards to Venezuela, is it historically any different than the role that South Florida politicians have played in influencing Cuba policy for the past couple of generations?
No, not much difference. And I think what you're seeing is that Florida, and particularly South Florida politicians, are finding it very easy to slip into the role of advocating for change in Venezuela, precisely because they're so accustomed to playing that role with Cuba for so many decades. And I think that's why you're seeing it, such a natural thing now for Florida politicians like Governor Scott to show up, you know, whereas they used to show up at Versailles in Little Havana, drink some Cuban coffee and shout Cuba Libre. Now they show up at the Arepaso Dos in Doral, eat arepas and shout Venezuela Libre. And so, you know, this is a very easy shift for them in terms of that kind of policy.
And it's not just Republicans, we should
exactly.
know. It's
exactly.
also Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, for example, who's having a roundtable
today
with
right.
Venezuelans, mm-hmm. Because there's really no opposition in Congress right now. I mean, even the lawmakers who once would have, you know, went to Hugo Chavez's funeral, who were considered kind of, you know, more leftists in the U.S. Congress, have denounced this election
and
under Maduro.
And both parties are astute enough to know that the Venezuelan population here is going to be an important voting bloc. The wave of migration that you've seen in the past decade escaping the revolution in Venezuela is educated, it's fairly affluent, and it's going to have, I think, an easier track to citizenship and therefore voting rights than many other groups from South America and Central America that we have here.
Let's talk about that influence on local politics. In 2016, more people from Venezuela requested asylum in the United States
right.
than folks from any other country. Majority of those coming to South Florida. We've got about 103,000 Venezuelans, men, women, and children, calling home in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County. Tim, a fraction of those, of course, are going to be registered voters, which is an even smaller fraction of the total registered voters in South Florida. So the question becomes, Tim, and to Patty, as that population is likely to increase, where are the places to look for continued influence? And perhaps the parallels and lessons from our Cuba history.
Well, Doral is, of course, the largest enclave for Venezuelans here. But you also have enclaves like Weston, for example. And again, these are places that I think as this population grows, you're going to see Doral making sort of a bid to gain the kind of political clout that Little Havana enjoyed for so long. But a lot of it's going to have to do with, you know, are they going to show the same kind of impressive voter turnout?
Yeah.
That the Cuban population here showed for so many decades.
And Patty, that's certainly the case on the national stage to some degree, certainly on the state stage. What about in municipal elections? I know that's not necessarily right in your target, but are we beginning to see Venezuela politics begin to infiltrate down to the municipal level?
Well, the former mayor of Doral, Luigi Borja, is Venezuelan, but he's not the mayor anymore. There was a Venezuelan candidate to the Weston City Commission who lost, and there is now a Venezuelan Democrat running for the state house, but her chances don't look very good. The voter registration numbers from Professor Dan Smith at the University of Florida suggest there's about 35,000 right. Venezuelans who are registered to vote in Florida. About half of them are registered without party affiliation, which is why we see the jostling of politicians of both sides trying to win them into their party.
Yeah. Let's talk about the role of the state government response. It's been mentioned about Governor Scott certainly visiting Doral and showing support for the opposition. Folks and the residents here in South Florida and Venezuela that still have family and obviously are still closely tied to the community in Venezuela. He is going to be proposing at the Florida cabinet meeting in a couple of weeks a policy that will ban the state of Florida from doing business with any organization that supports the Maduro regime. Patty, how symbolic is this? How much teeth could something like this have?
It's mostly symbolic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen no evidence of the state actually investing seriously with any companies that have major business in Venezuela. I mean, there's like the General Electrics of the world that have business everywhere. But, you know, this is a governor who we think is going to or is likely going to run for the U.S. Senate next year. And elections in Florida are razor thin. And if these Venezuelans become one issue voters and can give him a little boost, then so be it.
Tim, your thoughts on this move?
No, I agree completely with Patty. This is a very symbolic move. Florida, even the Scott's own financial officers this week admitted we just don't do that much business with Venezuela. So it's great political symbolism for the governor. But really, even the sanctions that President Trump announced, this week, sort of targeting President Maduro and freezing his assets, it's not really being taken that seriously on Venezuela. The only real sanction that would really buffet the Venezuelan government would be if we were to cut off oil imports from Venezuela. That would be but again, if we were to do that, we would have to step back and say, okay, how much pain would that cause to the average Venezuelan? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of costs involved in taking what a lot of people are calling the nuclear option.
It was just a week ago, that was an option that we spoke about quite a bit here on the mm-hmm. Roundup, and that's something, Patty, I think that Senator Nelson has talked about as well. But the sanctions that the Trump administration came forth with after last weekend's vote did not include the ban on Venezuelan oil imported into the United States.
No, and that's one praise from experts across the board who say targeted individual sanctions have helped bring along the international community.
Yeah.
And that if other countries impose similar sanctions, not just against Maduro, but against his inner circle, they're going to increasingly box him in. He won't be able to travel not just to the U.S., where he probably had no plans to come anyway, but to Mexico, to Argentina, to Spain, if other sanctions get in the way. And they say, these experts, that we are starting to see fissures, cracks, from some within the government who really don't want to be next, who are trying to save themselves. And if that's the case, that might explain why the Trump administration is choosing not to go for a broader economic sanction. We've reported that an oil ban is not really on the table right now.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can get the support of the international community to continue doing what they're doing, that might be more effective for now.
On the other side of sanctions, and there's lots of other sides, but one of those is immigration. Tim, is there any discussion within the State Department, about a immigration treatment of Venezuelans that may differ or change slightly because of what's happening?
No,
lately?
I don't think they want to go down any sort of wet foot, dry foot path on Venezuela. And again, I think the Trump administration's immigration crackdown is not really going to affect that much the Venezuelan situation, because as I said before, much of the immigration you see from Venezuela sort of falls under that, educated, affluent, these people are bringing capital, they're bringing degrees, they're bringing English.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see them, being really heartily affected by that.
All of which, those three things mentioned in the legal immigration
right.
reform proposal
the Raise
that,
Act, right.
that
mm-hmm.
President Trump endorsed earlier this week. Tim Padgett covering Latin America for us here at WLR. And Patty Mazzei, always great to have you, political reporter with our partner at the Miami Herald. Stay close. We got plenty more to come here on this edition of the Roundup. High tide and heavy rains this week. Were you flooded on Monday? Call us. Let us know your experiences. 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576. Fighting back the floodwaters is next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
It was an awful lot of water that came down very quickly and, really hammered us.
That's Eric Carpenter. He's the Public Works Director at the City of Miami Beach. 9 inches an hour. That's how fast the rain was falling on Tuesday afternoon. My mistake earlier. It was Tuesday afternoon when that storm came through. 9 inches an hour at the Sunset Harbor section of Miami Beach. Valerie Navardi is in an apartment building. She lives near that neighborhood. Her parking garage flooded. like it has several times already this year.
I'm kind of like used to it. I'm not new to the rodeo. But this time, the way it happens was very violent. It was extremely fast. I have never seen anything like that before.
She says it's the worst one she's seen because it happened within 30 minutes, a few feet of water in her garage. Miami Beach has spent close to $500 million raising streets and installing a series of pumps to battle high water, but it wasn't designed to deal with so much water so fast like what happened on Tuesday. As the head of Public Works, Eric Carpenter, he is responsible for the pumps, including the ones in the Sunset Harbor neighborhood, which lost power during the worst of the rain.
We've got a whole lot of water pouring down. We've got, downspouts coming off of some of the buildings and really pouring water into those lower sidewalk areas. And I see, the pumps keeping up as best they can until the power goes out, and then, things start to turn hairy.
Did the system perform as expected if it weren't for the power outage?
Yes. And, we put our system in place to handle 7.5 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour period. Our pumps and our stormwater systems in their entirety are designed to handle just under 3 inches of rainfall per hour peak intensity. When the intensity gets significantly over the 3 inches per hour, that's when the pumps have a hard time keeping up.
And Tuesday's event at its height was three times that, right?
Correct. The challenge that we had on Tuesday was that all the information we were getting from the National Weather Service was saying between 1 and 3 inches of rain max. So we're basically of the impression that it's going to be a typical, summer storm event. It's not going to be anything of the magnitude of what we saw on Tuesday. And so we did not pre-position generators like we had for Hurricane Matthew.
So it wasn't a matter of there were no generators to be hooked up. They weren't in place. And the power outage time frame, the 50 minutes, didn't allow to go get the generators and bring them to the pumps.
And interestingly enough, we actually had the generators on site when the power came back up.
Now, the flooding was not confined to the beach, certainly. Parts of the Brickell neighborhood in Miami looked more like a lagoon. Kelly Samardak saw the flooding from her Brickell office.
I looked out the window from the 23rd floor that I work in across from the Publix, and the street was just completely inundated with water. It was like a ridiculous amount of flooding.
So as it happens, as the water rose, so did everything else in the neighborhood.
And then we noticed these what looked like 80s cassette tapes just floating down, giant 80s cassette tapes floating down the 9th Street, and they were construction barriers, and it was so ridiculous. Like, cars were just ramming them and pushing them out of the way.
So if you want to know what a floating construction barrier looks like from 23 floors up in Brickell, it looks like a cassette tape, a giant cassette tape, apparently. How come this summer storm saw these waters rise so quickly? What should we expect from the tax money that's being spent on fighting floods? And what about this threat of high water from rains or the ocean, from Miami Beach to Las Olas to West Palm Beach? Has it changed where you live and where you work? 800-743-WLRN. The flooding this week, 800-743-9576. John Morales from NBC6, a meteorologist, is with us in studio. John, great to have you back in the program. What's the meteorological explanation of what happened on Tuesday?
Well, so we had Tropical Storm Emily that was a short-lived storm, made landfall in Central Florida. And Emily was starting to depart the state, but there was an elongated area of low pressure known as a trough that extended from Emily into the state of Florida. And south of that trough, where we are here in South Florida, there was some wind convergence. In other words, the air was converging in one spot. When air converges, it can't clash and sink because it's not stronger than the ground, of course. It clashes and rises. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that accentuates the vertical motion, which leads to stronger thunderstorms. Of course, we needed a trigger for all that, and the trigger was daytime heating, right? So it all started to happen in the early afternoon after the peak heat of the day was here. That made the air more buoyant, and that led to the deluge that we saw. It is, by the way, our third 5-plus-inch deluge in 2 months in the greater Miami area. And the average return period for 5-plus inches of rain is once every 2 years, and we've had 3 in 2 months.
So unprecedented, almost. Very unique.
Certainly unique and something that we've been observing with greater frequency now. It's these ridiculous deluges that occur more frequently.
El Niño, La Niña, anything related there that could help explain these deluges?
Well, I mean, there is no, we're in neutral right now as far as the El Niño, La Niña situation is, so it's none of that. But I can tell you that this is consistent with what you would expect with a warming atmosphere. And I'm sure our listeners at WLRN are aware of the fact that a warmer atmosphere can sustain more moisture in it. So when it rains more strongly.
Joy Fletches is along with us as well, covers Miami Beach for a part in the Miami Herald. Joy, did your feet get wet Tuesday afternoon?
A little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Tell us, describe what you saw, where you were.
I saw a little bit of it, but most of it was recorded mostly by our fellow reporters. But from Brickell all the way through South Beach and across Miami Beach, actually, there were a lot of sidewalks and streets that had pools of sitting water. Cars were splashing through it. There were parking garages underneath condo buildings that were flooded. Some first floor businesses were flooded on Alton Road, Sunset Harbor, even on West Avenue, and then across the city in low-lying parts, particularly on the west side.
So you heard our conversation with Eric Carpenter, the director of Public Works, saying that the system that the city has invested in, the higher streets and the pumps and the drainage, the $500 million that has purchased, covering 15% of Miami Beach, there's a lot more to come. But he said the system worked.
He did. And to an extent, you know, it's true. It worked as designed. But a key issue with what happened on Tuesday was there were no backup power generators that are permanently installed on the pumps that exist already. So the 15% that's covered, right. And most of that 15% did work. They didn't lose power. But in Sunset Harbor, which is sort of, it's hoisted up as this poster child for adaptation in the face of rising seas, right?
Yep.
And more inclement weather. The businesses on that lower sidewalk, it's about 2.5 feet lower than the street now that's been raised, they flooded. Yep. It was like a lagoon in there. And that's because during a 50-minute period, the pumps weren't on and didn't have any power to draw from.
We spoke with Eric Carpenter, the Miami Beach Public Works Director, about the next step, and he told us on Thursday that he had been given the green light to go get those permanent generators purchased and put them in place in the Sunset Harbor neighborhood in the next 90 days.
I've been given authorization by the city manager to, on an emergency basis, negotiate with any and all vendors to be able to make this contract happen and get these permanent generators installed. But, you know, I will have to take responsibility for the fact that those generators are not in place. We were trying to get to a place with the vendor where we were saving money for the city and we were also getting a top quality product, and we just could not get them across the finish line.
I think the Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine described this as a procedural delay, a procurement delay. Is this going to go wider, further beyond just those two permanent generators?
There's some political will that I've already discussed with some of the commissioners that suggest, yes, they'll probably want to look at this as a situation that extends to the entire pump program, which is, like you said, 15% through. So you're talking, and I don't know if you asked Eric, but this is $250,000 to $500,000 expense per pump.
That's right. Per generator, per pump.
Per generator, per pump,
yeah,
correct.
That's right.
And so it is significant.
Yeah.
That's not a little bit of money.
No.
Now, they have already decided that they're going to raise stormwater rates. They've done it twice already to pay for the $500 million pump program. So, you know, I mean, it's interesting. Procedural delay that the mayor brought up. They were warned about this. It's true. I mean, it's fair to say, like, they knew that they needed generators. And one of the engineers who was part of crafting this overall pump plan actually emailed them more than a year ago and said, hey, you ought to think about maybe backup power, because what happens in the case of a storm? And the fastest they could move, I suppose, was approving this February,
right.
2017.
That's when they approved about $1 million for these two generators,
right,
that they had been in the process of negotiating with the contractor. And then after Tuesday, now they are
now moving faster.
800-743-9576 is our phone number. What were your experiences on Tuesday afternoon with the deluge, a very unique deluge, 5 inches, is that right, John Morales?
It was in Miami Beach, over 7 inches of rain, and yes, sometimes coming down at an excessive rate. And then that extended towards the southwest across Brickell, and even into parts of southwestern Miami-Dade County, down in Howard, in that area, they also had 5+ inches of rain that
day. Yeah, it was Miami-Dade this time. What about the Las Olas neighborhood next time? Western Palm Beach County. We know Palm Beach County is bracing for new FEMA flood zone maps, for instance. It may be your neighborhood next. 800-743-9576 is the phone number. Let's go to line one. Ricky is with us from Boca. Ricky, welcome to the Florida Roundup. You're on the radio.
Hi, how you doing? Listen, I grew up on the beach from the 50s on, and I can tell you, we never had water like that ever growing up, ever, never. So people have to realize the ocean's definitely rising, the climate's changing, and Miami Beach for sure is sinking, no doubt about it. You know, it's all fill anyway. I mean, it's got to go down. It can't stay there forever. You know that.
Well, actually, it's Ricky, you have a point. This is John Morales. There is subsidence going on the western side of Miami Beach. That is, like you just said, all fill.
Right.
So, you know, while the seas are rising, parts of Miami Beach, perhaps not the historical part, the strip, the high point of the beach, that part's fine. But the western side of Miami Beach is most definitely sinking, too.
You know, and John Morales, Ricky, thanks for the phone call. You mentioned the warmer atmosphere. What about the warmer ocean temperatures? We're in the heart of hurricane season. There's two areas of interest right now. We know one of them not threatening Florida, the other one still way out in the Atlantic. But what about the role of warmer ocean temperatures?
Well, I mean, so first and foremost, the thermal expansion of the warmer water in itself adds to sea level rise, and that's definitely a factor. And you know, we haven't mentioned on this program, but you're probably aware that a contributing factor to the severe flood that we had on Tuesday was the fact that high tide occurred at 4:57 p.m. that afternoon, and the heaviest of the rain was between 2:30 and, say, 4:30 as the tide was rolling in. Because when we give you a high tide time, that's the peak of the high tide, but the high tide was in progress.
Which begs the question, if this were to happen in late October, if this were to happen in late November, those are key dates for tides because those are times when king tides happen and we get those dry day flooding episodes, not just in Sunset Harbor, but in the Las Olas neighborhood, in Hollywood, in other locations.
There's a lot to be concerned about in terms of water in all of these coastal and or low spots across southern Florida. I saw a lot of Twitter banter between meteorologists from Hurricane Center and elsewhere. You know, what is going to happen the day that we have a hurricane bring a storm surge towards any of those communities, especially if it's at high tide, especially if it's a slow-moving system accompanied by, 10 or 15 inches of rain? It's going to be epic and just a very sad sight.
Let's go back to the phones in Miami Beach. Ben, you are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, hi. I'm very happy you're having this conversation, but I think that every time I dial in and listen to this conversation, the point that's being missed is what's happening to this highly contaminated stormwater that we're so anxious to get off the upland and get rid of. This water now contains pesticides, fertilizers, fecal coliform, and it's being dumped into Biscayne Bay under the guise of stormwater, which in fact it's crossed threshold and has become wastewater with all the additives that I just mentioned to you. And it would appear that the city of Miami Beach is politely looking the other direction and not seeking answers for the proper disposal of stormwater.
Ben, we got it. It's a great point, and thank you for bringing it up here. Joey Fletches, we've seen some commission response in Miami Beach bring up just this point about pitting essentially pumps and dry streets versus the health of Biscayne Bay.
There was one commissioner this week that pointed out that, yes, the water that is being pushed out has some contaminants and pollutants that it would have had before because it has the new systems do filter out solids like plastic bottles and aluminum cans and the like, some plastic bags. But it's the concern is with more events that would trigger the pumps, which includes just regular sunny day flooding, and I mean, you know, definitely situations like what happened on Tuesday. It's more efficiently pumping and forcing water into Biscayne Bay at high rates, whatever that water has in it, it's going to put a lot of it into the water, into the bay. So there is concerns. And the city at first last year, you know, the Herald did some reporting on this, and they were very, very upset about it, and they pushed back very hard. And
because the scientific water quality report came back and found all of the kinds of contaminants, many of the contaminants that Ben in Miami Beach was mentioning.
Yeah, that's Henry Briseño's work over at Florida International University. And my goodness, I mean, the attack on the science was just...
It was incredible. Yeah, and people seem to forget that happened.
Out of Miami Beach's administration, I'm talking about, attacking the science.
Right, right. And the response, you know, they've said in a sort of more humble tone afterward, months later, like during King Tide last fall, they said, well, you know, you shouldn't hang out near the pumps if you're in the water when they're on. And the city is looking at possible solutions at the pump, actually outfall site, possibly like UV rays or something to actually try to get the content of the
water. There were questions about having the proper environmental permits to be able to pump some of this water into Biscayne Bay.
No, a couple of years ago there were.
Yeah.
They were trying to respond to the physical, like, you know, the presence of water on the street, like in Indian Creek, when that was a problem, and they were putting emergency pumps out there so fast that Durham couldn't keep up. But, you know, that's... and it's a complicated process because on one end you do have what we described in the first part of this segment, which is a businesses losing business because of water, and then where do you put it and how do you put it out cleanly? It's tough.
800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Craig is on line 4 joining us from Miami Beach. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the roundup.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One thing I wanted to mention was that we had a similar episode about 7 years ago. I live in the Sunset Harbor area, and I remember the flood water staying for a far longer period than what they did this last time. So while it took more than 24 hours for water to recede, I would say by 6 hours, I was able to walk back to the street, which I wasn't able to about 7 years ago.
Craig, appreciate you sharing that experience, Joey. That has been pointed to by Public Works at the beach as well. While even the pumps that lost power for 50 minutes and the water backed up pretty significantly and pretty fast because of the volume of water, once the pumps came back on and the power came back on, it was able to clear the streets and the sidewalks a lot faster than if the pumps hadn't been there.
That's right. In previous instances, people could kayak down Sunset Harbor for a couple of days maybe. And the Mayor Philip Levine actually campaigned on that image of him doing that 1 year.
Yep, yep.
And it's true. They have drained faster.
Henry is also on the beach in Miami Beach. Henry, you are on the roundup. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm also calling from Miami Beach. And in my neighborhood, there was so much water that when we actually came home a day late from Montreal to avoid the storm, but the day late was when we had a lake in front of our house. And so we had a hard time just convincing our taxi driver to drive us all the way to our house. You know, because we didn't know how we would get all of our luggage through that, you know, like walking through the lake. But my neighborhood is also scheduled at this point to have the road raised. And if our road had been raised, even if it had been mediated, as they say, to go to the houses, first of all, it was so high that the water still would have been on the road, and everything that wasn't on the road would have been in the yards and in the front doors and inside the homes. So I'm not sure that, you know, raising the roads the way they're planning to do makes sense at this point until they do some more research.
John Morales from NBC6.
Well, I mean, and think of those businesses that were affected just the other day that are now lying, you know, a good meter below the road level. There was an incident with a previous flood a few months ago where one of those businesses put in a claim for water damage, and it was denied by the insurance because now they consider their business to be a basement where it wasn't in the past. So I mean, there are many more repercussions to this adaptation work that's going on for climate change that people think about. You know, and you mentioned the higher fees. Mm-hmm. You know, talk about a carbon tax. I mean, you know, there's already a carbon tax being imposed.
I mean, it is really, if you think about it. And to the point of Sardinia, which was that restaurant in Sunset Harbor that put in a claim, that situation has not been sorted out, something I checked on this week. And that happened in October. That happened 2 days before Matthew, you know, passed by offshore. That area, his restaurant was flooded. The insurance company told him he's a basement. They told him to refile his claim, but it's still he hasn't gotten his money.
Yeah, the knock-on effect of not only the adaptation work, John, that you speak about, and Joy, that you cover, is significant here, because not only the flood insurance, talk about the financial side. If the owner of that building winds up wanting to sell the building and the plat comes back with no basement, but the insurance company or the mortgage company says, no, there's a basement here. So it's a different kind of insurance product that one needs, let alone the kinds of zoning type of rules now that are going to have to be put into play.
It's a huge logistical nightmare, to be honest with you, but it's something they're trying to tackle. And I mean, to the lady's point, she's living, as she says, she's in a neighborhood that's scheduled, which of which there are many at this point that are on deck to get these road raising and infrastructure upgrades. But there's a lot of resistance. I've talked to a lot of people who say, I don't want to have to put up with this pool of water in my yard. That's going to, I mean, and I understand why.
Sure.
You have to understand
why.
But then the city wants to soldier on.
We received this text via our ground source connection, Michelle from Miami Beach, saying that she was stranded in a parking lot for 2 hours. Because she said every street on Miami Beach heading east was flooded, and she didn't want her car to be ruined. She says that it was so scary. 2 hours later, when I drove home, there were still flooded areas. Had to go backwards to avoid ruining her car, to go trunk first as opposed to engine first. I suppose that's one technique. Not advised, though, but one technique. But, Joy, it does get to the point. 15% of Miami Beach has been adapted with these higher streets and pumps. What is the timeline look for the other 85%?
That's a good question, because as a result of the resistance in some of these neighborhoods, the city has had to listen to the voters, listen to the taxpayers, and say, well, maybe we'll not take – maybe it's not a 5-year plan anymore. Maybe it's more like a 7-year plan. And that number could keep shifting depending on political will and what the reaction is at each neighborhood level, because people say, well, don't do this to me. Don't do this to me right now. But then if you don't have the pumps – then you will have the sitting water for longer. It's,
right.
I mean, it's how do you make that decision?
And listen, I think it's important to remind everybody that all this work, all you know, this $500 million in expense, folks, this is just a Band-Aid. It'll gain us another 20 or 30 years, but then the water is going to keep coming.
And it won't stop.
It won't stop. So, I mean, the frequency of sunny day floods or any type of floods in these coastal vulnerable communities is already increasing. There was a study from UM that was published in the Herald not too long ago that, you know, it's 400% higher than it was just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And that will only exponentially rise as the ocean continues to rise and we continue to get these extreme rainfall events with greater frequency. And on top of that, we have a built-out community where there's nowhere for the water to go, so I mean, there's not enough percolation going on for the runoff to run away.
We're hemmed in water on all sides here, John Morales, from the Everglades to the west, to the ocean, to the east, of course. John Morales, a meteorologist with NBC6. Great to have you back on the roundup.
Thanks
so much for coming in, John. And Joy Fletcher, you stick around. We got to talk about booze on the beach next. Joy covers Miami Beach for a part in the Miami Herald. That is coming up, still to come. Last call, 2 a.m. or 5 a.m., how late should the liquor flow on South Beach? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, as the roundup continues. The sound of South Beach on a midnight, early Friday morning this week. South Beach is the place with the party reputation, isn't it? It's the epicenter. Just a few blocks of Ocean Drive where the dancing and drinks go on until 5 a.m. Carissa Ford, Carl Wesley Jr., and China Williams were among the crowd out there early on a Friday morning.
Ocean Drive is always going to be loud. Like, even the few streets back, like, most people that don't want a party scene shouldn't move near here because it's a party block.
Everyone's adults. Everyone works hard to make their money. If you want to drink till 5 a.m., drink till 5 a.m.
That's the whole reason why people come here. That's one of the main reasons I love coming here. It's that free, you know, opportunity to do that. So I don't think it should be cut to 2.
Well, this November, Miami Beach voters could decide whether or not last call should be 5 a.m., remain at 5 a.m., or move up by 3 hours to 2 a.m. on Ocean Drive. This week, businesses sued the city to stop that vote. So here we are, booze in the beach. Joy Fletcher is still with us from the Miami Herald. What's Ocean Drive like at 5 a.m.?
5 a.m. is when the lights come up and people in various states of inebriation are catching their ride shares to go home or to the hotels. And you get the sense that there has been a giant party every night ending at 5 a.m.
So what will the referendum potentially ask voters? Do we know what that language is going to look like?
It is a binding referendum, according to the city, that would allow the city to pass an ordinance cutting off alcohol sales at 2 a.m. instead of 5 a.m. Between 5th and 15th Street on Ocean Drive.
Now, the lawsuit that was filed earlier this week on behalf of several businesses on Ocean Drive claimed that the city, that it's not a binding referendum or can't be a binding referendum, among other accusations.
Right, yeah. It says that it accuses the city of writing an unclear ballot question that is misleading to voters. It doesn't say the word binding, so is it binding or not?
Right.
And it also accuses the city of violating its own charter by bypassing a process that exists where the planning board should review these kinds of changes.
So, you know, there was a time that Fort Lauderdale was spring break capital of the United States. Throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that reputation grew and got worse, according to some. And Fort Lauderdale was very purposeful in moving spring breakers north, first to Daytona Beach and then to other locations. So this kind of ability for a municipality to change its party hard reputation has been seen here in South Florida. Are the lessons that Miami Beach is taking away from what Lauderdale did in the late 80s, early 90s?
There's a lot of talk about that. And it's funny that statement alone seems to have two sides in this debate here in the beach, which is that, you know, businesses say, look what happened. You know, they're struggling. They're in recession. And I don't know if there are numbers behind that, but specifically, but and on the other side, the residents say, look how nice it is,
yeah,
and look how livable it is. Mm. So it's the kind of a classic theme here for Miami Beach, which is how do you serve the permanent taxpaying residents? How do you serve, where your bread is buttered,
yeah,
tourists coming in,
yeah,
and spending money?
800-743-9576. Just a couple of quick moments here for some phone calls. Adam is joining us from Miami Beach. Adam, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi, my name's Adam. I live at 16th and Drexel on Miami Beach. I think this is a political stunt by the mayor. Well, he's been talking about the crime and the noise in entertainment districts. The city of Miami Beach spot zoned a new entertainment district at 16th and Drexel in Miami Beach for one of the mayor's political cronies. 10 years ago, before they built the garage there, a permit was given that stated they could not have entertainment and they could have 140 seats. This year they voted to allow them to make it an entertainment area and to have 450 seats and 140 seats outside on the sidewalk in the middle of a residential area. So I think this is just a political stunt by the mayor that he's not sincere, because in other areas of Miami Beach, especially in Flamingo Park, he's expanding the entertainment district where his political cronies own property.
Adam, we got it. I want to let Joy Fletcher kind of respond to some of that. What about these questions or accusations?
Well, I'm interested in looking into that. It is true, I know for a fact, and a lot of people who live in Miami Beach will recognize that places like, say, Bodega or Purdy Lounge over in other parts of the city, literally on the other side of the island, have become very popular nightlife spots. And we're talking a couple of businesses here, but still, the thought is, if you kill Ocean Drive's party, will the party leave the city or will it just move elsewhere?
Is the party going to be like the water in Miami Beach where it's got to go somewhere?
It's got to go somewhere. And, to that effect, I was out there a couple of weekends ago talking to somebody who said, look, we're not going to go to bed at 2 a.m. We'll find another place to go. And that's something to consider.
Joy Fletcher, watching Miami Beach and all the things liquid in some cases that are happening on the beach for our partner, the Miami Herald. Joy, great to have you on the Florida
Thank
Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Finally on the roundup this week, two musical notes, one new, one historic. First, the new note. David Leon is 23 years old. He grew up in Miami, graduating from the New World School of the Arts and the University of Miami. He's a saxophonist and a composer. He wrote this piece, Me Versus Me. It's among the winners of the Herb Alpert Young Jazz Composer Award, and he'll be taking his saxophone and his Miami influence to the Newport Jazz Festival.
Well, a lot of that Latin music, I think I grew up definitely hearing it at parties and kind of dancing to, and it's in my musical blood or whatever, just because it's been around forever. It's definitely tinged the sound down here.
And one of those who has helped shape Miami music for years is Gloria Estefan. While not jazz per se, she has been the voice of the Miami sound for decades. And in December, she will receive the 2017 Kennedy Center Honor. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director here at WLRN is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The program director for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor today, Jason Zabka. Thank you, Jay. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. And have a great weekend.